There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to a new season of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst, and Don Fifield of The Athletic. So, this is the new normal. Lionel Messi leaves Barcelona because they're more than £1 billion in debt. No wonder the farewell to the world's best footballer felt like a state funeral. The depressing predictability of his probable move to PSG should make any football fan weep. The Premier League, meanwhile, ups the ante. Manchester City pay a British record fee of £100 million for Jack Grealish. Chelsea almost matched that to bring Romelu Lukaku back to Stamford Bridge. And as for Harry Kane, he's the central figure in a transfer saga from hell. Dom, money is speaking louder than ever, isn't it?
Yes, and I guess that was inevitable. While we spent most of the pandemic saying that most clubs are cash-strapped, there were always going to be a few that found a way of getting through it all, not least because they're backed by small states or oligarchs, etc., etc. But I think the Barcelona situation in particular is the most shocking to witness on the outside, because you to see an institution like that that has been so badly managed to have a wage bill, I think it was €671 million back in 2019-20. And it's, you know, they were charged with trying to get that down to nearer €200 million for this year, which is utterly infeasible. I mean, impossible. And it's culminated in the loss of their talismanic player, the player that probably La Liga needed most of all to survive and to retain some of its pizzazz and razzmatazz, etc. But it's, yeah, money talks, and it all boils down to that in the end. And it's no surprise to see the big spenders in the Premier League and which clubs are going out there and spending huge amounts of money. And it's what it makes for competition in the season ahead, I think, is fairly predictable.
Yeah, I think that's the case. You know, let's look at Grealish. His wages, £115 million over 6 years. Some merciful man has actually translated that to £369,231 a week. Good luck to Grealish for that. But isn't that the sort of salary that's an illustration of the completely skewed nature of modern football?
It really is, yeah. There are just not too many clubs on the planet that can come anywhere close to matching that, you know. So there may have been other clubs that wanted to take Grealish on, but who out there really would be able to pay £370,000 a week over a 6 year period? It's some investment, but look, he's a good player, and I guess what must rankle to City's rivals here is that they didn't really need a Jack Grealish player on the face of it, because I think we can all see that a central striker should be the number one priority for them. But yeah, look, they've got a player that's at his peak of his powers, and I don't think they'll regret the investment. I think he's a class act, something a little bit different. He'll add plenty of quality, things that City lacked to some degree in terms of creativity when Kevin De Bruyne wasn't out. And I think I think that's the crux of it. And if you, to simplify it, you've got to say that Kevin De Bruyne has played over the course of the last three seasons, not much more than half a season each time. And when he's been out, they haven't looked quite as good. And Jack Grealish comes in, his stats are right up there with Kevin De Bruyne from last season creatively. He was just behind him for minutes per assist. He created more chances in open play. So Jack Grealish is a great fill-in for Kevin De Bruyne, but when they're both available and when Foden's available, it's a dream team, isn't it?
Some fill-in, eh? You know, half an hour at Wembley in the Community Shield, you can't read anything into that. And you know, that game itself was a bit of a non-event. What do you think he'll bring to City specifically when it all settles down, Dom? Where do you think he'll fit?
It's a really good question, because they've got so many players, those sort of creative, free-spirited midfielders that could really operate anywhere across their front line. They could even probably operate as a false number nine if Harry Kane didn't rock up at the Etihad as well. I suspect there might be a period where he actually spends an awful lot of time on the bench to begin with, and then gets sort of drip fed into the team and will make an impact. Don't get me wrong. I mean, they are buying somebody who knows the Premier League really, really well, and it's not going to have an issue on that front. I think it's more about him adjusting to what Pep Guardiola wants his players to do. The process of Guardiola improving Jack Grealish has already begun. I mean, that started from the moment he signed on the dotted line, and he will be a better player for the experience that he's about to have at the Etihad Stadium. But I'd be surprised if actually he was nailed down to any one position. I think he could operate in the three in midfield. He could operate across the front three. He could operate wide if he wanted to. He could play as a 10. It's the same dilemma that Gareth Southgate had over the summer, but Pep Guardiola's got it with probably slightly better players.
You know, we're all inevitably making some degree of comparisons with, in terms of transfer strategy, between Jack Grealish and Harry Kane. You know, I thought Aston Villa as a club handled the Grealish situation really well. You know, himself or his people, you know, Grealish had legally binding assurances that he could go if Villa were offered $100 million by a club in the Champions League. Whereas Harry Kane, you know, he's citing a gentleman's agreement to leave Spurs, but that's never going to stack up, is it, Aid?
I guess not. No, it's not as good as the deal that Grealish had in place, that's for sure. Wasn't it great, by the way, that Aston Villa came out and explained to their fans the exact circumstances, the background and the history of that particular contract situation? I thought that was brilliant, and I'd like to see more of that really from Premier League hierarchy, if that's possible. But yeah, no, Kane, if Kane hasn't got any clause in there, and I don't believe that he has, then that word doesn't really count for a lot. All I will say is that when a player does, you know, speak out and express their desire to leave, then it very rarely ends with that player staying, knuckling down and deciding, hang on, yeah, I will stay forever. It's all right after all. Normally this, after a standoff, the clubs cave in and they end up selling him. And I just think that Daniel Levy is just looking for the biggest price possible. I cannot see how Harry Kane can stay at Spurs this season, given that he's made it crystal clear he wants out. And it's not too good for Nuno Espirito Santo either, is it? He wants to move on. He wants to get a group of players that are together fighting for the same cause. And to have the captain wanting out and just hanging around or being forced to stay is not ideal in my view. They have to come to some kind of compromise, Spurs, City and Kane.
But we have to interject and just sort of say, is Kane likely to agitate? I mean, do you look at him and think this is a person that's going to throw his toys out the home? When it first emerged that he might have skipped the first week of training and not been. It was a shock, really, that sort of spread around across the media and through the fan base, because it was so out of character. And it now appears as if there was probably a bit more to that situation than simply him going out on strike.
But if a gentleman's agreement has been broken and a promise, a verbal promise, look, yeah, give us one more year, and if one of the big guns comes in for, let's say, 125 million or above, we'll sell you. Or if we're not in the Champions League, we'll sell you. Then Kane is within his rights, isn't he, to kick off. And yeah, it does go against his character, but that option is always up a player's sleeve, isn't it? And although he would hate to have to do it, I believe that his ambition to win trophies, to go and join a superpower, will trump it in the end. And I think that is what he has up his sleeve to use against Spurs. And do you know what? Even though I hate to see it, I wouldn't blame him for it if that promise has been broken, whether it's verbal or not.
The only other gentleman's agreement that sort of regularly gets quoted in the Premier League is Wilfred Zaha, and the gentleman's agreement he was supposed to have struck with Steve Parrish. That was three seasons ago. I don't think anybody could say that Wilfred Zaha's commitment has wavered in the last 3 years.
No.
He had one game against Everton after handing in a transfer request where he didn't start, but he came on for the last 10 minutes and was still the best player on the pitch. And he's got another 2 years left on his contract. Kane's got three. I don't think he will go anywhere. Yeah. I think
it's his last chance, Dom. Yeah, all I say is that age-wise, was he 28 now? Yeah. I think it's his last chance to make this big move this summer. And it's the last chance, really, for Spurs to get the mega money. I think as soon as you start approaching the 30s, then that fee will go down, won't it? So yeah, when you're boxed into a corner and you know it's probably your last chance for that move, and you know that the champions want you, and no doubt they will pay him upwards of £370,000 a week, then look, some things are worth striking for. And I would suggest that in Harry Kane's situation, it would be worth agitating for the move. I don't like to see it, but yeah, you have to come to a compromise, I think, if you're in Spurs' situation. Nuno will not want this to linger on for too long.
Well, Nuno is apparently planning to have a, quotes, socially distanced, close quotes, discussion with him at training on Monday. So that'll be interesting to be a fly on that particular wall.
Oh, where's the all or nothing documentary?
Dom, what about, and you alluded to it there, he's a very, very pleasant guy, Harry Kane. What about the reputational damage that's being done here? You know, he's England captain, which has a certain cachet and one would say probably a certain responsibility. Can all that damage, which I think is probably quite real, can that be eased by an uneasy compromise? And you know, frankly, I think we've just gone too far for him to climb down, haven't we?
I thought that when I thought that Harry Kane, when the impression was that Harry Kane had gone on strike, I thought that is you burning your bridges at a club, and you are the local lad, the talisman within the icon within that squad and that club, burning his bridges. But it doesn't appear that that is necessarily the case. So I think it'd be dangerous to jump to too many conclusions on that. I think this is more akin, and I completely understand where A's coming from. I think this is more akin, though, to Steven Gerrard and Liverpool in many ways, back in 2004, 2005, when Chelsea came calling for him. And in particularly in 2005, after the Champions League win, when he witnessed, fans burning his shirt outside the Shankly gates and people spray-painting Judas on the walls of Melwood. That evening, when he thought that he was leaving Liverpool were even releasing statements saying what they were going to do with the money that they were raised from Chelsea, he had a panic attack. He had the club doctor come around to his house to try and calm him down, give him medication to try and get him through that panic attack, and then spent that night talking to his family before deciding that actually it's better to be an icon at one club forever and to feel as if that is your home and you can always come back here, than to burn all your bridges and basically, become a mercenary. Go off and play for a team that will definitely win you silverware, because that's what Chelsea would have done under Mourinho at the time. And that's what Harry Kane would get at Manchester City. But I think that the damage to him would be more lasting than that. I mean, I'm not sure that that would the trophies that he would win at City in the long run. I think he would suffer for winning those trophies for his relationship with his boyhood club.
Yeah, well, let's not forget, you know, we're in an unrelenting, unforgiving business here, aren't we? You know, Pep Guardiola has confirmed that he wants Kane. Surprise, surprise. He's looking for Spurs to move their negotiation stance. Surprise, surprise again. Let's look at Guardiola. He's spent £913 million as Manchester City manager, and he claims they can only afford Grealish, let alone Kane, because they've made £60 million from academy products. Now, I don't know about you, Aid, but he's been a bit disingenuous there, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit nonsense, isn't it? Yeah, look, they may have made some money out of sales. Every club does, but yeah, no, this is the ownership flexing their financial muscle, isn't it? It's as simple as that. It's nothing to do with selling in order to then go out there and buy. I just don't buy into that at all. Well, I do think that he's probably got too many creative attacking midfielders now. So there will be one or two casualties, I guess, this summer. And you've got to look at Raheem Sterling. If I was in Raheem Sterling's position, I would be nervous, slightly miffed at the signing, because for me, Grealish does his best work on the left of the attack. And that is where Sterling, of course, is at his best for Manchester City. So that's an interesting one. Bernardo Silva as well looks to have fallen down the pecking order. So it wouldn't surprise me if Sterling and Bernardo or one of those departed for pretty big money in the coming weeks.
But who's going to buy these players? I mean, isn't that City's biggest problem? And indeed, I mean, we'll come on to Chelsea in a bit, but I mean, Chelsea's biggest problem when they're trying to move bodies on to try and trim the squad is because by very definition, we started this show with talking about City, talking about the biggest clubs, you know, what's happening at Barcelona. We'll come on to PSG at some point. But those are the only clubs that have the big money to spend on a Bernardo Silva. There's no one else out there to buy a Raheem Sterling. It's sort of, not least because of their wage packages. And I mean, okay, a club might find a clever way of spending £50 million, spreading a cost over a course of a contract. And I suspect that's what Arsenal are going to do when they go out and buy players this summer. But the wage, you can't escape the wage. You have to meet that cost. That's an everyday cost. And there are not many clubs out there that can do that at the moment.
Because we are in an era, aren't we, Aid, where state-funded clubs are setting the agenda. And obviously Messi's put that into, you know, pretty vivid perspective. What I found most depressing about the whole Messy mess, if you want to call it, you know, there was a really poignant element to his farewell. You know, the tears weren't, that wasn't showbiz, that wasn't made up. Yet the ultimate outcome is probably the most boring possible, going to another superpower funded by a state, PSG.
You're bang on, Mike. It is the most boring destination for Lionel Messi. It's the most boring mega transfer ever, isn't it? Because there is only one place that Lionel Messi could go, and it's just so dull. It boils down to what Don was saying about who can afford him, who can afford to pay his wages, and PSG, it appears, are the only club out there that can, because Chelsea are putting their eggs in Romelu Lukaku's basket. That's their big spend this summer. Spurs are all out for Grealish and Kane. There's no one else. So, yeah, it's dull, it's depressing, but yeah, it puts the pressure on Pochettino. I mean, it will be a joy, won't it, for him to have Donnarumma in goal, Ramos at the back, and Messi, Neymar and Mbappe up top potentially, if one of them isn't sold. I mean, that is a dream for a manager, but with that also comes huge pressure. And yeah, look, if they don't win the Champions League, Pochettino will get the sack. I think that much is clear for all to see.
Yeah, I think winning the Champions League is now non-negotiable. How do you think Pochettino will handle the sort of human chemistry that is being presented to him, Dom? You know, he is popular amongst his players by reputation. But this is a different level of politics, isn't it? And trying to deal with the complexities of the egos involved, the brands involved.
Well, I guess it bodes well that Messi and Pochettino apparently have already had a conversation on the phone last week, and Messi took it upon himself to ring his compatriot to talk through the potential of a move to PSG and presumably where he would fit into it all, probably at the middle of everything. I'm not being daft, but Pochettino knew he had to cope with a fair few egos when he joined PSG. I mean, and long before Lionel Messi was an issue. I mean, that's that club's biggest problem since the Qatari money came in has been the number of egos in its dressing room and the fact that seems to undermine them at key moments in most Champions League campaigns, that they suddenly look like a team of individuals when they should be a team, a collective. I think when you're putting that much quality in, though, and as I say, you could probably ask Messi to just go out there and play, and he'll dazzle in Ligue 1. I mean, God, bloody hell, what are people at Lorient thinking at the moment? Dressed, bloody Lionel Messi's coming. Jesus, I mean, it's astonishing, but. Neymar's been on holiday also, and Angel Di Maria was also on holiday in Ibiza as well. I think they had they met up with Messi.
Yeah, photograph on social media, didn't they?
Yeah, so it's not as if he hasn't got friends there, people that he knows there, that they will find a way to play together very, very simply, and they are outstanding footballers all. I mean, what you look at that squad on paper, and it is frightening. I mean, we haven't mentioned Hakimi. Hakimi is an amazing player who they actually spent money on. And it's the supply line it's almost like the Barcelona team in its pomp, isn't it? Absolutely. It's an all-stars. They will wipe the floor with everybody in France, most likely. And I'd be surprised if they didn't do it in the Champions League as well.
Yeah. And also, it just begs the point, doesn't it, Aid? How can PSG give Neymar, I think he's on 30 million euros a season. You've got the Messi package, which is going to be north of 75, 80 million. You've got Ramos, who's not cheap. Wijnaldum, who probably is in relative terms. Donnarumma, if we forgot about that. You know, they paid Hakimi, they paid a transfer fee of 60 million for Hakimi. They're talking about losing over 200 million in revenue. Yeah, just try and explain to me in easy sentences, please, how on earth does this tie into any concept of financial regulation?
Financial regulations are dead in the water, aren't they? It's over. This doesn't happen if there are proper, enforceable FFP in place. PSG can't spend this kind of money this season. Simple as that. And they're taking advantage of the fact that everything's been lapsed, I think, post-pandemic anyway. While the world of football regroups financially, it's all been sort of put on hold, and they're just filling their boots, aren't they? Because they can, and it's their chance. They've blown it in the Champions League on numerous occasions, and they smell blood. They sense huge weakness in Spain, which is clear. They sense massive weakness in Italy. You know, everyone's selling up over there. Really, it's the Premier League against PSG, isn't it, for the Champions League this season? And they're determined to outspend everybody in a bid to achieve it. If you've got it, you can't blame them. It will make them despised. It will make them hated around the world because they are skewing competition. But if you're a PSG fan, life doesn't get any better than this, does it?
I'm not sure that the Xbox generation will hate them. I think PSG will suddenly have a new generation of younger supporters that suddenly spring up around
That's
the world,
true.
To be honest.
Yeah,
it's interesting. You know, looking at the financial markets on Monday morning, shares of all French clubs have absolutely soared.
Well, suddenly that television deal suddenly feels quite appealing, doesn't it now? It's like we're going to see Lionel Messi play every single week. Well,
yeah.
I mean, if we don't see him, we'll see Neymar.
Not a bad number two, I suppose. How will all this, I'll call it financially driven elitism, How would all that shape this Premier League season? And maybe, you know, we've talked about City. Let's compare the strategies for, say, Chelsea, Manchester United and Liverpool, who are, let's face it, they're going to be the other three in the top four, aren't they? Chelsea, what are the pros and cons of buying back Lukaku?
I don't see the cons, really. I think he comes back. Lukaku returns to Stamford Bridge three times the player that left all those years ago. He's a genuine elite centre-forward now. There aren't many players in his position that are comparable. You could put Haaland and Kane in there, I guess, and an ageing Lewandowski. But Romelu Lukaku is right up there at the peak of his powers. And Chelsea have always thrived with a dominant powerhouse number nine. And that was the missing link last season. Even though they won the Champions League, there was a missing link, and that was at centre-forward. And yeah, Lukaku coming in, for my money, makes them genuine title contenders, because Tuchel's a master tactician, the real deal. And they're outstanding, aren't they? Out of possession, very hard to create against. So yeah, I don't see the downside of bringing Lukaku back to Stamford Bridge. I mean, yeah, Dom might have an idea. He's closer to the club than me. I can't think of anything that negative about him returning.
Yeah, what do you feel, Dom? How you know, we asked how will Grealish fit in at City? You know, in tactical terms, obviously it's pretty obvious the way they're going to employ Lukaku. But what are the ripples in the pond? You know, who is going to have their nose put out of joint because of this?
Well, bear in mind, they've already sold Olivier Giroud. Tammy Abraham, I don't think many people envisage that he will be at the club come the end of the transfer window. I suppose you could argue that Timo Werner's nose might be put slightly out of joint, but in all honesty, he's been better as a supply line than as a striker since he came to the club. So if you've got Lukaku leading the line and any combination of Werner, Havertz, Hudson-Odoi, Pulisic operating...
Mount, obviously.
I mean, and he will play in one of those two off the front man as well. So, yeah, I mean, they've got so much talent from whom to select in those positions, and it gives them a bit more adaptability as well. I mean, they can certainly look to... They could switch formations again. I mean, there was one game away at Leeds where they played with a back four in the Premier League under Tuchel, and it looked a bit awkward, but you could see them even employing a 4-4-2 with Lukaku if they really wanted to. They've got that option now. It's, what, just shy of £100 million? I mean, bearing in mind that this is... We talk about him arriving at Chelsea 10 years ago as a kid from Anderlecht, but actually Chelsea tried to sign him subsequently. They tried to get him from Everton and they thought they had him. I think there was a conversation caught on camera between Emanalo and Lukaku in the tunnel at Goodison Park after a game up there, where I think Emanalo says, well, we'll see you in a few months' time. Well, he went to United instead. I think he's got unfinished business. I think he wants to excel at the club that he counted as his own when he was growing up. He had posters of Didier Drogba on his bedroom wall. I think this is something that he will want to achieve, and he can do good things at Chelsea. And as Adrian says, that is what they lacked. I think their leading goal scorer was Jorginho, was 7 last year, wasn't it, in the league?
Yeah.
So Lukaku will certainly surpass that.
I suppose, you know, one of the cons, in theoretical terms anyway, is, well, you know, there's going to be very little resale value out of this transfer. But on that, because the game has changed so radically, and I just want to almost take a tangential move here, is it a really big gamble by Dortmund not to cash in on Haaland at this particular moment?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is a good question. I think, is it Dortmund's choice not to cash in on him, or is there just is there no one out there that has stumped up the money that they're looking for, that is willing to pay Erling Haaland the wages right now that he would command? I think everybody wants to play that waiting game for the release clause, and Haaland himself, I don't think he'll be that fast, because the chances of him getting the premium wage packet are much better next year than they are this. So it might be that they've come to a gentleman's agreement themselves between Dortmund and Haaland, whereby, come on, give us another year. Yeah, we will take the hit on the fee, but it will give you the salary that you command. I don't know. Yeah, from Dortmund's point of view, you would have thought they would have wanted to cash in and have that bidding war. But it feels like with PSG going for Messi, City and Chelsea going for other people, Manchester United, you know, spending big, big money themselves, there's no one out there really to have Haaland this season. I think it'll be a next summer move.
Yeah, I find that puzzling, to be honest, because I think he'd be a transformational signing for anyone. In the Premier League, he would score at least 40 goals a season.
What about this? If Spurs dither too long over Harry Kane, then surely there's a possibility that Manchester City will dip their toes in the water with a late bid. They clearly need a centre forward and they want Kane. We've got a few weeks to go right now, so all their eggs are in that basket. But they could easily switch attention with a mind-blowing bid that Dortmund couldn't turn down. And I'm sure Haaland would take a salary of Grealish levels. You know, I don't think that's a bad deal for him, is it? So look, maybe that story isn't, you know, it's got a few more twists to run.
Yeah, it wouldn't entirely surprise me, I must admit. You know, we're in the land of sort of solid gold unicorns here, aren't we, Dom? how can a club like Liverpool, which has got a much more balanced financial strategy, compete with all this?
Well, I think Jurgen Klopp would argue that, well, they did some business early. They brought in the defender to strengthen Konate, yeah, to offer them another option, really. And after all the injuries that decimated their back line last season, that made a lot of sense. I think he cost over 30 million, 34 million, I think. And he would argue that the returning players and the fact that they're sort of schooled in the system that he was unable to implement last season because of the injuries. I suspect in his eyes, that's almost worth a £200 million new signing coming into the fold. You got a Van Dijk back who can set the tempo of the entire team from the back and set standard really as well. Konate can fit in alongside him. They've lost a key midfielder in Wijnaldum who actually, I think, played more than anybody else in midfield for Liverpool last season. So he takes some replacing. But there are other guys to step up. We still haven't seen anything from Naby Keita over the years, really, of any consistency. There are guys there that need to show their pedigree. You know, if that front three fires again, then they're still going to be a real force. I think the landscape is a lot tougher now, definitely, not least because Chelsea have emerged. If they get Lukaku through, then they are a stronger team than they have been the last few seasons. City are undoubtedly, they stepped up again. So it's an big ask to get Liverpool firing and competing for the title. But Klopp will look at it and think, I've got the ammunition there. I just need to get them firing again.
Mm-hmm. What about Manchester United, Aid? 120 odd million spent on Sancho and Varane. But I don't know about you, is there still a sense of almost incompletion there? There's still a couple of missing pieces.
Yeah, I think the missing piece is in central midfield in regards to a world-class dominator in there. I think obviously there's been a lot of talk of the young boy Camavinga coming in. You know, he could eventually be that guy. But no, they're not the complete team, but these two signings certainly put them on the right pathway, don't they? Jadon Sancho, a wonderful wide forward that scores goals, creates goals, great age. He will elevate Manchester United's goal threat significantly. I've got no doubt about that. And Raphael Varane, even though he didn't have his best season last year, I cannot see him failing at Manchester United. He's too good a player. He's got so much pedigree. I think he just needed a new challenge. And that partnership with Harry Maguire looks awesome to me. It really does. It just looks a tremendous partnership. I suppose in goal, they've got question marks. Who's going to be the number one? That one's a bit of a scrap. The other positions, I don't see a major issue. It's central midfield. What are they going to do with Paul Pogba? And who is ultimately going to be his long-term partner Is it going to be that Scott McTominay becomes that sort of Darren Fletcher guy that just always plays, even though he's not the superstar name? I rate Scott McTominay, but if you're looking for possible upgrades, then it is that position that I think they will spend big money on next.
Hmm. How do you see the whole Paul Pogba situation evolving and being completed, Dom?
Well, he was going to PSG this time last week. Appears to have been trumped there. I think PSG would much rather pick him up on a free transfer next summer when his contract expires at United. Look, that is the big question for me and United, because the prospect of losing him for nothing, having, you know, lost him for, what did they lose him for? 800 grand when they lost him first time round. Mm. I mean, it's that's pretty careless. I mean, it's how he, I mean, Adrian there is talking about a long-term partner for Paul Pogba. It may be that actually there isn't a long-term future for Paul Pogba at Old Trafford.
Yeah.
So you're actually thinking about reformulating your entire midfield and having a new midfield probably in place for next season, not this coming season. It is the big dilemma. It will continue to rumble on by the very nature of his representative and his own character. He will want to be in the limelight still. He'll want the focus to be on him to a certain extent. They both will. And Pogba will always remain that big dilemma, really. I mean, he was at the Euros, he was outstanding in quite a few of France's games. But, you know, in Hungary, he was completely off the boil, and France, surprisingly enough, weren't great. And then he was capable of the sublime and the ridiculous in the elimination against Switzerland. I mean, he did both, scored a fantastic goal, but also played his part in losing the ball in the build up to a Swiss equaliser. So that sort of sums him up, and you just sort of want to see more. You want to see more of the brilliant Paul Pogba illuminating the Premier League, but I wonder whether the contractual situation will be slightly too disconcerting on that front.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see where, you know, who would have him, because if you're looking at Serie A, that's pretty much a black hole financially now. So it will be interesting.
It's PSG again, isn't it? Let's be honest. It's PSG. Yeah. And that's despite the fact that his mother, I think, once came out saying that she favoured Marseille more than Paris Saint-Germain, which, you know, is sacrilege in France. You can't join the other one. They're already being protests.
Wouldn't you love to play at Marseille in front of those fans? I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Look, if there wasn't such a bitter rivalry, Liverpool sometimes lack that creative, match-winning central midfielder, don't they, that can just unlock the door. It's not going to happen, I don't think, but he would. That would be a destination. Liverpool is a strange one. I know that they've got a more balanced financial strategy, and kudos to them for that. But you do think, you know, are they sitting on their heels a little bit here? Can they try and be creative? Maybe use a Sadio Mane or a Firmino as bait to land someone else, just to regenerate that team. It feels as if, as good as their teamwork is, their tactical prowess under Klopp, they look short, don't they, compared to the others, if they don't make any more moves.
Mm. Let's look at Leicester, who, lest we forget, they've actually won a trophy this season already. Quietly impressive in their recruitment as ever, aren't they, Dom? I think Patson Daka from Salzburg might have a real impact this season. What about you?
Really looking forward to seeing him play. I've heard a lot about him, and he's one of these players that actually weirdly sort of illuminated social media long before it sort of came into the mainstream media's consciousness. A lot of talk about how he's been tearing it up over there, and the pace and the finishing that he could bring. So that adds another dimension, and it possibly relieves a bit of the pressure on Jamie Vardy as well up top. So, yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because we everything we've said so far in this podcast suggests that the top four is nailed on, that we know that who's going to finish in the top four. Well, actually, Leicester are the team that could probably most realistically, aim to disrupt that, the natural financial order as well. And the last couple of seasons, they've pushed and pushed and pushed and then just fallen away at the last. But I think they're undoubtedly making constant progress, and their recruitment is clever, it's shrewd. They've got to find a replacement for Fofana now, because he was outstanding last season. If that's that long-term injury, that will blunt them as well at the back, so they need to maybe re-enter the market there. But even like shrewd signings like Ryan Bertrand just coming in at left back for them, I think that's a really canny acquisition. Just someone just to pay, you know, make sure that there isn't any massive disruption there. They can get by, adds to a bit of depth to it all. And I fully expect them to have another really good season. It's just whether they're good enough to break into that top four, I'm not so sure.
One step ahead, aren't they, Dom? Yeah. Leicester City. And look, I'll be surprised if they haven't got a central defender lined up. I'll be surprised. Obviously, they wouldn't have expected to have to replace Fofana right now, but they'll have lists and they'll... Yeah, it might have been for next summer. Someone they'll have earmarked, I'm sure of it. I did a piece on Patson Daka recently, studying the goals that he scored last year, 29 of them in the Austrian Bundesliga and the Champions League. Great range. So he's got the pace, he's got the movement. He's a carbon copy, really, of Jamie Vardy in many respects. But he's got that varied finishing as well. 16 with his right foot, 8 with his left, 5 headers. So he's one of the most adaptable finishers in Europe. And this is the stat that really struck me when I was researching the piece. He scored one goal that was 3 touches. He scored 6 goals that were 2 touches. He scored 22 goals that were 1-touch finishes. And when you think about Jamie Vardy, when you think about the ammunition that Leicester creates, he's absolutely tailor-made for the Foxes. And yeah, I think there's a realistic possibility that Patson Daka might be Leicester's number one striker by the end of this season.
Yeah. Let's sort of begin to pull some of the strands together if we could, guys. I'd like your views on the activity of the clubs with which you're, you know, associated to a degree. Dom, Crystal Palace, it's all changed. Revision of recruitment strategy for younger value-added players, new manager, of course, Patrick Vieira. How do you see it all coming together? You know, again, a little bit similar question to earlier, pros and cons, please.
Well, the pros are that this needed to be done. You need the context of the 11 players leaving the club in the summer as well. Out of contract. I mean, not all of them have gone, actually. A couple have signed on for another year or two. But that was an opportunity for major wholesale change. And the club recognised over the last couple of seasons that the squad was getting older. It was the oldest average age in the division. So it needed to rejuvenate. It needed to be revitalised. And that's what they've done. And they've actually done, on paper, very, very well in the market. And I like the signings that they've made. Anderson did well at Fulham, and albeit in a relegation team last season, and they got him for a good price. Mark Gaye looks an excellent young prospect and a player that Chelsea didn't want to lose. Olise from Reading, when he's fit, he's got a back injury at the moment, unfortunately, but when he's fit, I think he was the outstanding talent in the Championship, for attacking talent last season. I think he'll do well. Conor Gallagher will offer energy and legs in midfield, which is something that Palace need. And they need to bring in, I'd say, 2 more than on top of that. And I think that they're making progress. I know they're battling with Southampton at the moment for Adam Armstrong from Blackburn, but I think the player has indicated that he wants to come to Palace. And I think on paper, those are really, really good signings, and exactly the type of signings that Crystal Palace should be making. It means that if the worst does happen and they get relegated, they've got some assets to sell. If they'd been relegated at the end of last season, they would have had nothing. They would have been in financial shtuck now. So it's sensible planning. The cons are that we just don't know how they're going to do. We just don't know how these kids are all going to gel and how they're going to... A lot of them haven't played in the Premier League before, and there's going to be a certain reliance upon them. They've got to hit the ground running with Palace. And moreover, Palace have got a manager who's never managed in the Premier League as well, in Patrick Vieira. He's done well at Nice. He did well at New York City. And I'm sure he'll look at coming to Palace and doing well as a stepping stone to joining Adrian's mob at some point in the future. I mean, and there's a perfect logic to that. I don't think many Palace fans would quibble with that, because it would mean that he'd have done a good job at Palace. But those are the great unknowns. I think everything at the moment is positive. Everything at the moment is positive. Whether it will be positive when they're 4-0 down at Stamford Bridge on the opening afternoon, who knows? But there you go.
Okay, well, we better get on to Adrian's mob then. Arsenal, I think it's £77 million spent so far, obviously most of that on Ben White. Linked with James Maddison, Kieran Trippier over the weekend as well. How do you see it all fitting together? You've watched a few of the pre-season games, eh?
Yeah, pre-season hasn't gone to plan. They've not really hit the heights that the fans would have hoped for. Obviously, this is Mikel Arteta's first proper pre-season. So hopes are high that he'll get into them on the training ground and take the team forward. But yeah, performances have been okay, but nothing special. In terms of the new signings, they all will add to the squad. Ben White was needed. He's got a bit of pace. He's a great distributor. So I think that's really important to Arsenal, especially now that David Luiz is gone. He will be pinging those balls across the pitch to Kieran Tierney. He'll be picking out the front players for fun. And he's a quality defender, the best defender that they've got. He instantly improves them. So I'm really happy with that signing. Sambi Lokonga looks great. He's very confident, wants the ball, will play a whole range of passes, just oozes class on the ball, really. Not the finished article. Might get knocked off the ball a bit in the early stages if he hangs on to it too long. But he looks like he's a player with real potential. And he might have to start the season with Thomas Partey injured. Thomas Partey, by the way, was sensational during pre-season until he got injured. So that's a hammer blow. And Nuno Tavares is rapid, honestly. He's one of the quickest players you'll ever see. Defensively, his positional play needs work. He's a bit raw, but his recovery speed is sensational. And he's also got a very good left foot and he'll make an impact inside the final third. This season, if Kieran Tierney's injured, and the chances are he will miss games, of course, given his record, then they've got a more like-for-like replacement this time because he's so offensive. Now, there's still holes that need filling. Right back is urgent. I feel that Arsenal really, really need a quality right back. I still feel they're short of a box-to-box midfielder, someone that's going to go out there and score goals for midfield. There's going to be a big reliance on Smith-Rowe, Saka and Pepe. But for me, I'd still like one of the central midfielders to chip in. So look, we'll have to wait and see. Yeah, Madison's been mentioned. I'd be happy if they signed Madison, but I think there are other parts of the field right now that are more in urgent need of repair. They need a goalkeeper to compete with Leno. And actually, I also think they need a striker. Yeah, there's a quandary at the moment. There's a massive quandary that Mikel Arteta is yet to solve. And that is what to do with Aubameyang and Lacazette. There's no sign that's been cured. He wants to put Aubameyang up top because of his goal record, but every time he plays Lacazette up front, he performs better and the team looks better for it. And Lacazette's goal record isn't too shabby either. So it's a bit of a problem at the moment. Arsenal have a lot of work to do between now and the end of the transfer window, and that they seem too far off at the moment to give fans reasonable hope that they can crash the top four.
Yeah, I think you can probably say that, or actually amplify that in terms of Spurs. You know, Christian Romero, £47 million from Atalanta, gives them a bit more defensive strength. Brian Hill from Sevilla, that would be quite an interesting signing. I suppose we draw it together, boys. Whose strategy or whose transfer window has impressed you so far out of all of them? Dom?
Well, I like the way that Villa planned ahead for Grealish's departure. I thought that was clever. I like the signings they've made as well, although I think Buendia's still got an awful lot to prove in the Premier League. I think he should be better this time round with better players around him than he was at Norwich last time. But look, I find it very difficult to judge transfer windows. I think I'm pretty sure I would have sat here the last two summers thinking that Aston Villa and Fulham had done brilliantly because they spent a load of money on some very good players, but none of it worked, none of it gelled. And, you know, Villa escaped on the final afternoon and Fulham went down. So I think it's dangerous to judge a transfer window until much later on into the autumn and towards the middle of a season. I like what Villa have done because that's been quite shrewd, and I like what Palace have done because it was necessary. They had to do it, and they've done it quite efficiently. But you know, let's judge them later on in the season.
Yeah, Aid? Yeah,
Yeah, all fair comment, I think, from Dom. Absolutely. I think the Villa is the standout. To get Leon Bailey, who's brilliant, by the way, really exciting wide player that can create and score goals. I think he's exciting. Buendia was unbelievable in the Championship, and I think he's ready to shine in the top flight. And Danny Ings. To get those three players for the Grealish money is really smart. Palace is great recruitment, I think. I agree. There are some unknowns, obviously, because they've played in the Championship, most of them. But I like it. The other ones that I would chuck into the mix as the big success stories, it has to be Manchester United, because they've finally got the Jadon Sancho deal done, and he instantly improves their attack. And Rafael Varane, I think, is a coup. I genuinely do. I think him and Maguire will be a formidable partnership. So, yeah, Manchester United, even though they're still, you know, maybe one or two short, that they've done excellent work.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd add to the common consensus. I think Villa have spent that Grealish money really wisely. They've added to their attacking potential, and quietly they've given themselves greater defensive depth, I think. If the transfer window is football by proxy, without the ball, they're probably the summer champions. The last word, though, I think should go to Lionel Messi. As he said in his farewell conference, players come and go in the end. Everyone has their price, however painful that is to accept. Fans make it personal. Clubs regard loyalty as a business expense. How does that make you feel? Please let me know. And in the meantime, thanks to Adrian and Dom for their insight, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.